You are listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
The Archaeology Podcast Network is sponsored by PCS Jobs. To post or view a detailed quality job posting, visit pcscourses.com/jobs. Hello and welcome to the Archaeotech Podcast, episode 52. I'm your host, Chris Webster, with my co-host, Chris Sims. On today's show, we talk about science literacy and the technology behind the 130,000-year-old mastodon site in California. Let's get to it. All right, welcome to the show, everyone. Welcome, Chris. How's it going?
Hey, good. It's funny. I guess let's start off with a quick announcement. I've stepped down as the editor for the Archaeology Podcast Network. It's been a wonderful several months. I was really happy to be a part of everything and really get a lot more, I guess you couldn't call it FaceTime, but a lot more quality time talking to all the other podcast hosts and all of the guests who have been a part of, you know, all the shows that we've been on, and just kind of helping the other podcasters get this thing going and just being part of a really great community of podcasters. And so while I am sad to go, I'm excited to start up working full time with Codify, and what better place to announce it than the Codify podcast? I mean the Archaeotech podcast.
Practically, right?
Yeah.
No, the complaints finally just stacked up so high, we just had to get rid of him. So the editing complaints. No, I'm just kidding. So Chris will still be a co-host on the CRM Archaeology Podcast, of course, this podcast, and his own show, Go Dig a Hole. So definitely check those out. But yeah, it's been fantastic and liberating for me to have somebody, you know, putting in 20 plus hours a week on editing, and then Chris took on social media without me even saying anything. I think it's because he saw a void because I wasn't doing it. just said, hey, let's put some posts out there. So that was really great, and it was nice to have. And it made me realize the importance of having somebody do that kind of thing, really just so you can have that separation from kind of the network. I ended up seeing a lot of this almost from an outside point of view because I wasn't hearing the show first from an editing standpoint like I usually do. I was hearing it for the first time most of the time as the listener would, and it helped me really see – where some improvements can be made in the network and things like that. So it was really great.
Yeah, and so the very first episode of any of the shows from the Archaeology Podcast Network that I got to listen to as a listener and not an editor was actually the episode that we're going to talk about today, or rather the site that we're going to talk about today. But there was an episode on the 130,000-year-old mastodon site that you recorded with several other podcast hosts and Stephen Holland, the lead author on that report. And so that, that is coming out on the Archaeology Show and the CRM Archaeology podcast, and it's already out on the All Shows feed. So, if you're having a hard time finding it, just go onto the website, archaeologypodcastnetwork.com. There's a search bar. Just type in like mastodon and you'll turn up that. I don't think we've said anything about the rock band or the clunky social network yet. So that's probably the only thing you'll turn up.
Nice. Yeah. If you're listening to this on the day that the show came out, it's May. Oh my God. It's May the 4th be with you. actually 2017. If you're listening to this in 2019, the world has probably ended by now, but if it's still 2017, then like I said, May the 4th be with you. And, so the Archaeology Show comes out in 2 days. if you want to wait for that, but the All Shows feed, it's going to be buried down there a little ways because we've had some other shows come out since then, but you can find it. And again, if you're listening to it this week, I'm going to leave up for another couple of weeks. There's a special link right on the homepage at arcpodnet.com. If you want to pause this show and go listen to that one first, and then turn the, you know, ringer off on my phone. Anyway, if you want to do that and go check it out and then come back and listen to this, we're going to talk about we're not going to repeat what was in that podcast. We're going to really get into a little more science literacy aspect here in the beginning, and then we're going to get into some of the tech that was not necessarily used on the site but used to date the site. So and some other things related to that. So I think it's going to be a good show. But first, let's talk about science and why science is important. A bunch of us that are listening to this probably went to some local March for Science event. And regardless of your reasons to go for that and whether or not it was a good thing or a bad thing, there's varying opinions on that around. But I think just the thing I want to take away, and I'd like other people to take away from the whole March for Science movement, is that science itself is important. And almost more importantly, yes, archaeology and even anthropology in general, I'll give them that, even though it includes those cultural guys, is a science, right? Archaeology specifically is a science. I mean, we use the scientific method. We create hypotheses. We try to, you know, find supporting information for those hypotheses. And when we don't, you know, then we move on and we change it. We do something else. And that's basically it. I mean, that's science right there. So, you know, Chris, you recently had a podcast talking about the March for Science, which we're not going to, you know, we might link to that in the show notes. But, you know, what are your thoughts on the crazy that's happened in the last couple of weeks?
Yeah, it certainly has been a wild ride for scientists, not just in the past couple of weeks, but the past 100 days.
yeah, right.
But yeah, so check out the episode of Go Dig a Hole on the March for Science. There's also one or two episodes on Arc 365 about that. I won't recreate the whole rant that Hannah Marie and I went on, but there have been some oppositions to the March for Science from scientists, and those oppositions are centered on matters of inclusion. And so as an organization, the March for Science organization itself is highly problematic in that the way they went about organizing and communicating and promoting their event had a lot of erasure of people of color and erasure of scientists, and archaeology and the humanities were among those fields that were kind of being erased. And so they were promoting this idea, this cultural notion of what science is. And starting off, they promoted it as a non-political event. Part of that was strategic so that they could get permits to actually have the event. Because as we've seen, a lot of permits to protest have been revoked for other groups. So it was a strategic move, but it was an ill-advised PR move. It wasn't a good look. And so it faced a lot of backlash. And so in the end, though, the thing is that it brought about a conversation among supporters and detractors alike over what science is, who is a scientist, and it brought the focus, I feel, back onto the scientists, the people actually doing the science. And I think that that's an important thing to remember. And so, you know, moving forward, there are people with disabilities. There are people of different, you know, non-binary gender. There's people of color. There's, you know, people of all classes, of socioeconomic class, I mean, doing science. And science is everywhere. And like you said, if you're applying the hypothetical deductive method or, you know, any sort of variant of the scientific method, whether it's qualitative or quantitative, you're a scientist, just plain and simple. It's so much bigger than, you know, just chemistry and engineering and physics and all that. And recently on an episode of Curiosity and Focus, Daniel Kwan explored the question of what is science and what is a scientist. And he had a really good way of summing it up by saying, it's simply someone who's curious and explores questions and uses questions and curiosity to look for answers. And in the end, it's not about the answers, it's about the questions that make a scientist. So yeah, I really like that approach.
I used to say that a lot when I was, you know, field teching back in the Southeast and we were doing shovel tests and stuff. I was on my way to becoming a crew chief on this project, and You know, I used to tell the people whether they'd been in longer than me or not. I didn't care, but I was like, you know, let's be good scientists today and say things like that. And I actually had arguments with a few people that were like, we're not scientists. Shovel testing isn't science. That's not doing anything. It was like, I mean, it might seem like that because all you're doing is digging holes and getting bit by mosquitoes and, you know, dodging snakes all day, but and picking ticks off your body. But you're actually doing science. You might not have come up with a hypothesis, but there are research methods associated with every research question, associated with every project, whether you know it or not, whether you were told those research questions or not, you're helping to try to answer those research questions or ask new ones. And that's the whole point of what we're doing. Every single archaeology project out there, even if it's a cell tower, is science, because your research question is, you know, is there any supporting evidence here that, you know, anybody lived here ever? So you go find out, and you dig holes, or you walk around, or you do whatever works for that methodology for that area, and you just answered a research question. You came up with a research question, or maybe the FCC did for you, and then you went out there, you tested your hypothesis, and you wrote up your findings. That's science. I hate to tell it to you, but you know, that's what we do, and we're all scientists. Archaeologists, especially shovel bums, just kind of feel, kind of feel dumped upon every once in a while. Like, we're not scientists, we're just ditch diggers, and because that's kind of what they're told. And I think we need to value ourselves a little higher. So, anyway, this sounds like a topic for something that's not the Archaeotech podcast. let's get in. We're halfway through the first segment, and we may as well start talking about one of our primary topics here. Like Chris said, we interviewed Dr. Stephen Holland, who's the lead author on a letter that was sent to Nature on April 26th. Actually, it was sent probably a long time ago, but made it into Nature by April 26th. And I say letter because people are calling it an article, but there is a distinction. It's not nearly as long as an article, although in this letter, it really was just – it's set up like an article. You know, they kind of laid it out. It's not very many pages long, honestly. It's just laying out exactly what they did, what they found, the research methods. And then there's something like 70 pages of including some video of their research methods. It's all supplemental material, and they go through some experimental archaeology. They go through some they really explain some of the things they did. They have some conclusions, like every paper does, you know, or letter or whatever. You know, they kind of – at the end, they're like – what does this all mean? We don't know, but it could mean this or it could mean this. And they're really vague about it intentionally. And they say that they're vague about it. And even Dr. Holland, in the podcast we did at the end, I asked him, you know, without making any sort of proclamation on this that has any basis in reality, you know, you guys, like everybody else, go to the bar at the end of the day and sit there and talk about what you did for the day. What have those conversations been like? Where do you think these people came from? And if you don't know what we're talking about, go listen to that episode, or, you know, go look up one of the articles. But basically, you know, 130,000-year-old site, he's making conjecture that it was some form of, you know, Homo species, maybe not Homo sapiens, maybe was, who knows. But it was somebody, maybe not even an ancestor of the current Homo species or Native Americans that live in this area or anything like that. It could have been somebody that got here somehow, maybe even accidentally, and then died out, and then there was another wave that came in. Who knows? We don't actually know. So let's talk about the paper a little bit. Let's talk about the setup. Again, the paper, if you haven't read it, really just boils down to here's what we found and here's what we did to it. That's it. That I don't think it's any more than that, quite frankly. And they're leaving it up to the scientific community to kind of go over it and, you know, maybe even go down and to the San Diego Natural History Museum and go over the material themselves. You know, if somebody wants to go down there, they're more than happy to do that, more than happy to let people do that and go down there and do your own research on these things and figure out what's going on. So, Chris, when you first heard about this, what was your initial reaction? I'm interested in that. My initial reaction, just in a word, was, you know, that's fascinating. Let's find more material. let's find more sites like this and figure out what's going on down there. So, I mean, what was your initial reaction when you saw this last week?
When I read the headline, I audibly went, "Oh shit!" it was, I wasn't like outraged or anything. And I was, my personal initial reaction was, wow, I just can't believe it. But, you know, I was like, stranger things have happened. I don't know. It's pretty wild. Like in Portugal, for example, the study has been going on for, you know, the better part of like 25 years, but to relate it to a similar kind of paleoanthropological find, there's a fossil hominid, Neanderthal, I believe, that is 400,000 years old over there. Hmm. And there's a lot of debate over what exactly makes a modern human. And to push the dates back that far is just astounding. And so for us to see, you know, the timeline for the peopling of this planet just keep getting pushed back farther and farther, and the means and the placement and the timing of the peopling of different parts of this planet, they keep mm-hmm. changing. And so for us to see this, I was like, okay. Similar to you, I was like, all right, I want to know more about this. Let's see what's going on. And mm-hmm. I remembered I was at the SAAs. It was either in St. Louis or Austin, where a Chilean archaeologist laid out the evidence in a similar fashion. He just said, here's what I found. Here are the dates for it. It suggests that there was human activity at least 25,000 years ago at this site, and people got up and walked away.
My God.
Out of his talk. And yeah. That was, I don't know, that was what, like 4 years ago, maybe longer, when I saw that. And I feel like for people to say 25,000 years ago in Chile is no longer something that raises hackles in the scientific right. community. So who knows? Who knows? I'm not saying let's accept it right away, like, you know, at, you know, without any criticism, but I think that it's worth debating and it's worth looking into. And anybody who read the letter and anybody who listened to the podcast that Dr. Holland did with you, he's very open about, you know, accepting other views on it. You know, he mm-hmm. wants other views on it. And as he should, because it would ruin his career if he didn't.
Yeah, and yeah, you know, I agree. If this is the only example we have, which it seems like it is, I mean, there's the Calico site, which Louis Leakey was invited to dig up, and also in California, he was invited to check that out. And that's an early man. In fact, it's called the Early Man site. That's what it says on the highway. And I can't remember what kind of time period they were looking at there, but I know that he was called out there because they had what looked like, I think it was like Oldowan choppers, you know, that date to like, I don't know, something like 1 point some odd million years ago, you know, in Olduvai Gorge that Louis Leakey helped to identify. And he was called out to that site. And we talked about that on the podcast. And Dr. Holm was like, you know, the biggest difference here is the geology. The Calico site had really poor geology. There's rocks everywhere. And some of them look like they could be tools, but some of them don't. And when you have that many rocks, and if there was a high energy environment ever, and they're smashing into each other, nature could make rocks look like tools. We've all seen it. Anybody that's worked out in the West here that's worked on a hillside, you know, and sometimes you find just a rock that probably rolled down over, you know, successive generations of freeze-thaw and eventually made its way to the bottom. It hit other rocks on the way down and very well could have caused flakes, very well could have caused other things. So we look for corroborating evidence on that stuff. And the biggest difference between that and just before we go to break here, the Cerruti site, it's called the Cerruti Mastodon, named after the person who was initially monitoring that, is the geology. The geology at that site, there's fine sediments at that site with these big rocks and then this paleo material, this bone material, not just from Mastodon either, from a lot of other animals. But the rocks that were found in association are, and the stone tools, what they think are stone tools, were found next to this Mastodon site. So in association with it. And that wouldn't have happened naturally very easily, because when you have a site that's well sorted like that, we call it, that meant it wasn't a high energy environment. So water wise, so there was, if there was ever water there, which lays down these sediments, then that water was moving slow enough that it couldn't move the big rocks. It couldn't move the bones and the bone pieces that were left there, but it moved the sediments all around it. So it was a very low energy environment. And it would take a lot of high energy to bring that stuff in, and they're just, it was just not like that. So
yeah, that was really the key. Yeah. that Dr. Holland said is, if high energy was involved, how could it have moved the large rocks without moving right. all of the small pieces of bone and the small sediments?
Right. Exactly. So that's one of the keys, I think, to at least associating all this together. We're still not making any determinations here. All we're saying is these things probably happened and were here for a reason at the same time. That's really all we're saying. So let's take a break real quick, though. And when we come back, we'll get into some of the dating methods that they used and why those are important. Professional Certifications for Scientists, or PCS, aims to provide practical educational videos, field guides, knowledge tests, professional certifications, and employment connections to professional scientists everywhere. Check out the jobs page for job listings in contract archaeology. Post a job for just $50. All of PCS's jobs are verified and checked for completeness. Find PCS jobs at www.pcscourses.com/jobs. PCS, a place for good scientists to become great science professionals.
Okay, and we're back. And so as we left off, the real key here is to talk about relationships and context in the association of all these materials. And this all relates back to what we were talking about in the first segment about the scientific method and all of the science that underpins archaeology. So there's a reason why these things would be in relation to each other. And that was one of the things that Dr. Holland and his team explored at this site. And that's why it took them the better part of 30 years to even present these findings, because none of it made sense. None of it was fitting with the various technologies and various hypotheses that were being put out there. So Webby, you have your finger on the pulse with this, but you know, correct me if I'm misstating any of this. So as they're going through, they tried different scientific methods and different dating methods. And so when they started off with radiocarbon dating, it just wasn't working. And then they go on to OSL, and that just wasn't working. And it took, you know, 30 years until this uranium, what was it, uranium-thorium?
Thoron, yeah.
Thoron.
Yeah, or thorium. I think you're right. I think it is thorium. Yeah, uranium-thorium dating.
Yeah. When they started investigations at this site, that technology had not yet been developed for testing. And yeah. So
or at least wasn't cheap enough for archaeology.
Yeah. And so then finally this method comes around and it's actually feasible to use, and they sent these samples out without saying where they were from and what they were being used for. And the dates came back, and the researchers at the lab were like, oh, wow, 130,000 years, like plus or minus a fairly tight range.
Yeah.
And they go, by the way, what's this from? We're just curious. And so, you know, Dr. Holland and his team go, it's from an archaeological site in San Diego. And the labs were like, no.
Nice. Yeah, so let's dig into that a little more, because some of our listeners may not be familiar with some of the dating techniques that we use in archaeology. In this country, in the United States, in case you're listening to this somewhere else, we rely heavily on radiocarbon dating, because radiometric dating in general relies on the half-life of materials. So what that means is radioactive materials deplete themselves by half on a certain time frame, and it just depends on the material. Carbon-14 actually, it depletes itself in 5,000 and change years. Okay, I don't remember the exact number. It's 5,200 or 300 something years. That after that amount of time, half of what you started with will be gone. So you have to know how much you started with. That's the first part of radiocarbon dating. And because it depletes itself in 5,000 years, any amount of radiocarbon in the atmosphere that collected inside of your organism and that was set when that thing died, it takes Just because of the half-life, it takes about 50 to 60,000 years, and that's really pushing the upper limits of this, before all the radiocarbon is gone. So you can't actually date it. If the object is older than that, it really shouldn't have any measurable radiocarbon in it. So if you're trying to measure that ratio of, you know, what's left, then you're not going to find anything. And that's what they tried. They tried to radiocarbon date the collagen in these mastodon tusks, and it wasn't working, and they really didn't understand why. Well, turns out they thought, I don't know what they thought. My guess is they probably thought, oh, it's just not a good sample, or, you know, it's contaminated or something like that, because it probably wasn't even a thought in their heads that it was actually ridiculously old and it wasn't going to work anyway.
Yeah.
A dating method that I'm not as familiar with as I should be. I've heard of it a bunch of times, but I've never actually used it myself. But that's optically stimulated luminescence, which, if you're a savvy listener, you'll notice I said thermoluminescence like an idiot in the podcast, and I didn't edit myself out. But Dr. Holland, gracious as he was, just kind of bowled right over that, and he's like, so we tried optically stimulated luminescence. I was like, all right, thanks, buddy. It was all luminescence to me. It's all the same. But anyway, I tried that, and basically what I can tell you, just based on what he told me in that podcast, was OSL dating generally works to about 60 to 70,000 years because of the way that it works. And that wasn't working either, which was also puzzling because, again, they didn't know how old this was. So the next one that was tried, like Chris said, was uranium-thoron dating. And basically what that means is uranium, I think, 234. If you want to know more about this, purely coincidentally, Tristan Boyle, co-founder of the Archaeology Podcast Network, who's also an archaeochemist, he did an ARC 365 episode that aired on Saturday, April 29th, about uranium series dating. And it was the day that we recorded this interview, and then the next day, Sunday, we posted the interview. So if you want to know about that, go listen to that episode. I can't believe that just by coincidence it came out that day. We weren't even planning on it. But anyway, it's the same thing, half-life, except uranium, these heavier elements, they have half-lives in the hundreds of thousands, if not millions of years, sometimes billions of years for the really heavy elements. So you really have to have precise measuring tools to say, you know, how much is left. But the uranium, from what I understand, decays into thorium. And when you measure, when you know how much uranium generally the planet started with, generally a substance started with, and then you measure how much thorium there is, you can measure the amount of time it would have taken for that ratio to build up. And that's where they came up with 130.7 thousand years, if I'm not mistaken, plus or minus 9,000 years, which is pretty tight for something like that. So I think they could have done that back in the 90s, but it wouldn't have been as precise possibly, and it would have been way more expensive. As with everything, things like that come down in price. So that's basically it. That's what changed everything. They knew that. This is the fascinating thing for me too, is they knew they had an archaeological site 30 years ago. I mean, they looked at these things. They saw the boulders that were likely used to bust up these femurs, and the femurs, I think they were femurs. Either way, they were big mastodon bones, you know, long bones, and they were busting them up right in the middle, because across the world, we have evidence that people have done this to make bone tools. He mentioned an Acheulean hand axe that was made out of elephant bone, basically, in, I don't know, somewhere over in Europe. Well, probably some kind of mammoth bone. And they're all somewhat related. But, you know, I don't know.
Pachyderms. It's all right.
Fluffy pachyderms, whatever. So anyway, you know, we know that this is a common thing that's done around the world that was independently invented across the planet, probably thousands of times, if I had to guess. I mean, you see a fragmented bone sitting there, and you're like, "That's sharp. Can I make more?" I mean, that's not really that hard to come by. So that's what they have. They have these fragmented pieces. I think they mentioned thinking that they were maybe going for the marrow, but then possibly not. It could have been just something that, you know, a group of whoever's found and then said, "Hey, let's bring some big boulders over here and make some expedient tools out of this, because maybe there's not any other material around, or maybe they just know that's good." I don't really know, and I don't think they know either. But that's the evidence. That's what we had. And so they're like, well, these are clearly bone tools. Maybe not clearly. They had world-renowned experts check these things out and come up with the conclusion that they were, in fact, looking at stone tools and, in fact, looking at bone tools, or the creation of bone tools. And then the dating came in. And they were like, "What the, you know, excuse me?" And that's when the shit hit the fan, so to speak. So I don't know. Chris, what are your, I mean, I don't know what to say on this. You know, that's the evidence, and the conclusion seems pretty clear.
Yeah. Well, I would say to go back to the reactions that you and I had off the bat, I'd say that mm-hmm. you and I are perhaps more accepting than some, because each of us has a background in like paleoanthropology. Mm-hmm. You've studied, you know, early hominid sites in Africa, and I studied you know, Paleolithic sites in Portugal, and you know, we've seen these kinds of tools, and we've seen the kinds of weird geology that goes into making these sites, and it's the kind of thing that you just don't really see in North America. And there's a point that Sonia discussed with Dr. Holland in that episode of the podcast that you did with him that kind of raises some important points. Well, there's no kind of, it really does raise important points about our methodology and how the way our methodology works for identifying sites in North America is based on the hypothesis that sites are only going to be up to a certain age. And, you know, that age right now, you know, is contested, but it tends to be not greater than 15,000 years. Mm-hmm. And so the whole survey and excavation methodology hinges on the premise that there's no way humans were here before that. And so this site flies in the face of that. And right. So, you know, that just means that when we're going through and we're testing sites, we're testing for a certain age and not for deeper ages. And, you know, that's not to say that we're not going to find these sites, but I think that it's entirely possible that there are other sites that are older that have been missed. And, mm-hmm. You know, there's other points too that Dr. Holland raises. One is the reason we're not seeing, or one of the big reasons why we're not seeing sites of this age, is because they're probably submerged and they've probably been destroyed by wave action, because 130,000 years ago was the last glacial maximum. And that was when the sea levels were, you know, at their lowest, and around 125,000 years ago would have been kind of the last chance to get on board in North America until sea levels rose incredibly rapidly and environments also changed rapidly, you know, and therefore the plants and animals available to human or even non-human predators were changing, mm-hmm. you know, drastically every single day, every single generation for thousands of years. And so it's a really interesting idea that this site could have existed and could have survived in all of the sorts of environmental factors that have erased sites like this, or, you know, potential sites like this from archaeological detection. And so this is the one that had the right geologic exposure and the right, you know, preservation of context to be able to detect and study these things and offer a tight enough range and a tight enough idea of the associations of these deposits to actually be able to show that some activity was happening. Mm-hmm. So I think it's really cool that they're able to even show any of these things.
Yeah, I agree. It's kind of amazing. And for people to, you know, I want to talk about interpretation a little bit here, for people to take a look at this and then flat out deny it, you're saying to yourself and to your peers that you disagree with a number of things. First off, you'd agree with the principle of principles of geology that state, you know, how things will be sorted. You're saying you don't agree with that. You're saying you don't agree with dating methods, so there's that. You're saying you don't agree that, and this might be true, that the stone found in association with the bone was not actually in association with it and came to it by other means or even other time periods. You know, it sounds like somebody might be saying that somehow early Native Americans, even if you're going to stick with those theories, sometime in the last 15,000 years, found these mastodon bones and then broke them up and did something, or at least dropped a bunch of rocks there, because experts have stated these are stone tools. But you're also saying that you disagree with that, that these are stone tools, that the experts that have looked at these sites that are similar to these, the one expert they had look at this stuff has seen stuff like this in Australia. He's looked at the Homo floresiensis sites on the island of Flores in, I think, Indonesia. And this guy independently has come up with all these things. I mean, they sent him some samples. He looked at these things and he said, yeah, these are stone tools. Where are they from? They're from a 130,000-year-old site in California. The guy's like, what the hell? And so they flew him out there, and he spent 4 days looking at the rest of them and poring over these things. And his conclusion was, yeah, I'm gonna back what I said. These are stone tools. I can't explain it, but they're stone tools. You know, I'm not going to make any pronouncements about the rest of the site, but these are stone tools, you know, regardless. So if we buy that those are stone tools, then, you know, you don't necessarily have to buy that they're in association with the – with the 130,000-year-old mastodon bones, but somehow they got together, you know. And the most logical explanation is, based on everything that's sitting there, is that they are, in fact, in association with each other.
Yeah.
So.
And I think that raises a good point, that it's a good thing to be critical of this. And I think that it's a good thing to be critical, period, of anything, and that's what makes good scientists. But there is a difference between being critical and being reactionary. And what I've seen in terms of the social media response has just been breathtakingly disappointing. And it's been this knee-jerk reactionary response where people, I believe, are not even reading the letter. They're not listening to the podcast, and they're posting these angry rants calling it pseudoscience, and even saying that Dr. Holland is malicious in his statement of the site, which is a fairly neutral position too. He doesn't speculate. Right. And even in the podcast, when you asked him to speculate, he wouldn't do it. And it's to ignore all of the scientific training that goes into critical thinking and to just bypass all of that in making a reactionary statement is so disappointing to see coming from other archaeologists. And, you know, it's like, what are we all here for in these archaeological communities? It's to refine the conclusions of these sites. And so, you know, if someone is critical of this site and they end up pouring through the data or saying, well, actually, you missed this one thing, and you know, it couldn't be older than X, you know, XYZ or whatever, you know, then that's great. That's great. Then you've just refined the resolution of that data. But to say that your 30-second rant that you post on Facebook is going to absolutely shut down 30 years worth of data that has, you know, undergone intense scientific rigor and, you know, just gone through the whole process time and time and time again because it wasn't matching with the hypotheses like we were talking about earlier. You know, to say that your little rant that you post on Facebook is going to shut that down is just utterly ridiculous.
Yeah. Well, I think as we close out this segment and this discussion, the one good thing about Facebook is if you posted some crazy thing about this on your own page, then you're probably preaching to the choir if you're like most people. Like, your family and your friends are probably all kind of aligned with you, most likely, and you're probably not going to hear a lot of dissent. But if you were one of those poor, unfortunate souls that posted in an archaeology group, then you were immediately peer-reviewed. Because I have had some serious discussions and arguments, really, and not just me, but me and a few other people, and there's always somebody in there that's like, well, let's look at this a little closer, you know, and there's, it seems to be the minority opinion right now, but at least that opinion's in there and it's being discussed, which I think is a good thing ultimately that this came out and it was so divisive, because that causes people maybe to sit back and think, you know, that's why we're doing these podcasts and this is what we're focusing on it so much, because I don't want to try to tell anybody what to think, but I want to make them think to begin with. So rather than just react, have a thought that is based on science and reality. And again, I'll just say one more thing before we close this out to bring this back to technology. Chris and I and a number of other people have seen this time and again, where whether it's an app or a piece of technology or something like that is applied to archaeology, if it's not a well-accepted thing, like, you know, I feel like Trimble GPS, submeter GPS is usually a Trimble, ground-penetrating radar, some other things are well-accepted pieces of technology, but you try to bring something else into the field, and the knee-jerk reaction is, I'm not going to do it, I like my notebook, or I'm not going to do it, I like my XYZ thing. You know, I want to bring the freaking Tesla Model X into the field, you know, but I've heard people say, I'm not going to do it because it's electric and I don't want to be caught with a dead battery out in the field. I get that, but that doesn't mean I'm never going to do it. I'm going to do it eventually. When I can afford the $180,000 to buy one, I'm bringing that down. I'm putting a screen and a shovel in the back of that thing and I'm going to the field. So,
yeah. Well, and here's the thing is just to go back to one more point on this site and on the note of the scientific method is Dr. Holland at the end of that episode of the podcast put out a call that essentially says that he wants to be able to reproduce those findings at other sites. So he has some funds available to come out and study old sites in North America because he wants to be able to reproduce those findings in other places.
Right.
So, you know, read it, listen to it, get in touch with him if you have a site, because honestly, nobody is going to approve you digging to find a 130,000-year-old site. Nobody's going to say, oh, yeah, that method sounds totally sound. Why don't you just go knock yourself out? Here's $500,000.
Right. Yeah, that's going to be pretty tough. And, yeah, you know, they made the argument, we're going to cut the app of the day segment a little short because, you know, we don't have good apps to talk about. But please continue to listen. Anyway, we made the argument for CRM at the end, which is why this cross-posted on the CRM Archaeology podcast. And he said CRM archaeologists need to start digging deeper. And the only thing I would caution about that is sometimes there's a reason we don't dig deeper. You have to look at the structure or thing or reason that you're developing. I mean, if you're surveying over what's going to be an open pit mine in Nevada, then yeah, dig as deep as you want because they're going to go down a mile and destroy everything. So, you know, there you have a good case for going deeper, even though you're maybe at a sterile context or something like that. If you have a reason to go deeper, then do it. Check it out. But if you are in San Diego or if you're in, you know, somewhere where they're putting up a building or they're putting in a road, it's your kind of due diligence to say, you know, what's going here? Know that. And say, what is your footprint? What is your disturbance level? Are you only going down 15 feet and this, you know, an older site might be 30 feet down or something like that? I don't know how deep these things even are over there, but, you know, the deeper, the older typically. So it's a method of preservation that some people don't agree with if you simply don't dig it up. If you auger and you know there's something down there, but you also know that the development is not going to hit that level at all, any shape or form, then you probably shouldn't dig it up. Just as a way to preserve things. The archaeology is not here just for us to dig stuff up. It's also our job as CRM archaeologists specifically to preserve things. And sometimes the best preservation is not touching it at all. So, in fact, always the best preservation is not actually destroying something.
Go figure.
Sometimes that's hard to get our minds around. We think the best preservation is to dig it up, learn from it, and put it in a museum or in a box somewhere, which, sure, we learn a lot, but it's not preservation. So, you know, that's kind of our first goal is to manage those resources. That's what's in the title. And we can manage them by preserving them and then record it. Hopefully the next person that comes through there when they dig deeper will be able to find those records and then move on. So, all right. Well, let's end that rant and that barely technological rant for the ArchaeoTech podcast and come back in a short span of time for the App of the Day segment. Back in a second.
Professional Certifications for Scientists, or PCS, aims to provide practical educational videos, field guides, knowledge tests, professional certifications, and employment connections to professional scientists everywhere. Check out the resources page for useful links, a directory of CRM archaeology firms in the U.S., and a link list to state site forms. Find PCS resources at www.pcscourses.com/resources. PCS, a place for good scientists to become great science professionals.
And we're back. And so, Webby, you want to kick it off with your app of the day?
All right. So when I started listening to podcasts probably close to 10 years ago, I think it was 10 years ago, I just started using Apple iTunes because that's the only thing I knew that was available to actually find podcasts. Turns out there was other ways to do that, but I didn't know any better. So I was looking through iTunes, finding podcasts, and then those would download to my computer, and then I would plug in my iPod. If anybody remembers doing that, had no wireless connectivity whatsoever. I would plug in my iPod and then sync the podcast to my iPod, which would by default, because it was an iPod, play in Apple's podcasting application. Applications, in fact, weren't even really a thing because the iPhone wasn't around yet. It was just the iPod. Whatever Apple invented was on your tablet or your iPod. So when smartphones became a thing and other ways to listen to podcasts on a mobile device started happening, I eventually switched over to an app called Downcast because the Apple Podcast app wasn't doing what I wanted it to do. First off, I didn't want to have to sync with iTunes. I wanted to just be able to download and subscribe. And I don't know if you could then or not. But the other thing is Downcast was a paid app, so it had a lot more features. It allowed me to create folders, to listen to podcasts at more than one times speed. So incremental, like 2x, 3x, things like that. I typically listen to 2x. At the time, Apple wasn't allowing that, or they hadn't added that functionality. And so, you know, Downcast does a lot of things for me that I like. Well, recently, I started hearing, you know, I look at the statistics for the Archaeology Podcast Network, and a fair number of people, it looks like, listen on mobile, and not only that, but listen through iTunes. So if you're listening to this through iTunes, then this is for you, because just a few weeks ago, I downloaded again the Apple's podcast application because I'd heard that they'd done some improvements to it in the last couple of years, and I wanted to check it out. I wanted to see what the user experience was like listening to APN podcasts. So now, as of right now, and I might be changing this after this review, but as of right now, I listen to all my APN podcasts on the Apple Podcast app. And I'll tell you the good things first. One, Apple, of course, integrates well with Apple. So you can share podcasts easily through a text message or other means. You can see it on the home screen really nice. The layout is good. You see the album art, or in this case, the podcast icon. You see a lot of really good information. They do allow you to increase the speed now, so you can go 2x, 3x, whatever you want to do. And all those things are really nice. Inside the app itself, it's simple. It's laid out relatively well. You can search for a new podcast pretty easily. You can see your podcast. You can listen to a playlist of all your podcasts. But there are three things that I simply can't recommend this app for, why I would recommend going to another app. And it doesn't have to be Downcast, which I believe is $4.99. There are other ones out there that are free, but you get what you pay for. Anyway, the three things I don't like that the Apple's podcast app does, or doesn't do, rather. The first thing is folders. I listen to lots of different podcasts, and I like to organize them into folders. So I'll have, you know, my archaeology stuff here, my general science stuff here, my, you know, business things over here. And then I'll go in and listen to whatever I want to listen to, but I'll listen to it in a folder. The second thing is the order of the list. So when you first look at your podcasts, you look at the list that has all your shows in it. The list is sorted from the most recent one downloaded to the latest one downloaded. And it's actually not by the download time. It's sorted by the date that the podcast was released. So if you downloaded an older podcast yesterday, it goes way down in the list because it's older. So, and again, it's from most recent to oldest, top to bottom. Now, when you click on any one of those, when it cycles to the next one, it goes to the next one down, which means it goes farther back in time. I'm a little OCD, and I like to listen to stuff in order, even if they have nothing to do with each other. I listen chronologically. So that really irritates me that I can't just hit a button on the top and just resort the list. I don't really understand why that's not a thing. Super easy to do. I mean, iTunes is based on FileMaker, which is a database application owned by Apple. It's an Apple subsidiary, and why they can't make that happen, I couldn't tell you, because I know FileMaker can do it. So the third thing is show notes. We have relatively extensive show notes on the Archaeology Podcast Network. Not some of our shows don't, because there's nothing to talk about. It's all in the content. But some of our shows have very extensive show notes with links and contact information and things like that. And what I found out is the little paragraph that we put in the metadata for the audio file that we submit to the website, which goes to iTunes, is the only thing that you see on Apple's podcasting app. When I tap on the album art, usually that's how you do it. You see the show notes, and the only thing I see is that first paragraph. I don't see any of the links. I don't see contact information. I don't see anything else, and that is a massive oversight. Downcast, on the other hand, shows me all the show notes. It won't show me photographs. If I have pictures in there or video, it won't show me that, but it will show me the entire list of links and everything. And if I click on one of those, they actually have an in-app browser. It doesn't go out of the app. They have an in-app browser that brings up wherever that link was supposed to go to. So if I'm driving, side note, I don't podcast and drive and click on links. Except I do. But anyway, if I'm driving or if I'm somewhere and I just want to quickly look at this, it doesn't take me out of the app. It doesn't take me anywhere. I can just click on a link and I can quickly see what those people are talking about. So those are the three things that I don't like about it. And because of those, they're too severe for me to be able to recommend it. So if you're listening to this on an Apple Podcast app, I would highly encourage you to check out another app or frequently check out the ArcPodNet for our show notes, because we put a lot of time and effort into those. So anyway, that's it for the Apple Podcast app. I can't recommend it because it doesn't do all the things I want it to do. But if you're happy right now with it, then that's really all that matters. It's like a cheap wine. If you think it tastes good, then keep drinking it. But I can't recommend it.
I use it just because I'm lazy. But then again, it fits in with the cheap wine metaphor.
Right. Nice. Well, that's all I've got to say about that.
Nice. Well, I don't have an app per se. I wanted to talk about how geospatial data gets used in apps and how it gets used, period. And so my inspiration for this is I'm house hunting right now, and boy, oh boy, is it an adventure. I'm hopefully about to become a first-time home buyer, and nice. I got to say, these apps like Zillow and Trulia and the real estate company I'm using has a proprietary one called Real Scout. I believe there's others like Redfin. Mm-hmm. They're really useful for looking at home listings on a map. And, you know, I'm sure a lot of you out there as archaeologists are thinking, well, yeah, no duh. But when you, like for Portland, for example, you go and you enter in all of these criteria, like say you're looking for a house that has a minimum of 2 bedrooms, minimum 2 bathrooms, under a certain price range, you enter that in and you get to see the smoldering crater of gentrification that is Eastside Portland, where you will never afford a house over there. And I actually got to tour a literal crack house that was being listed for $500,000. And
oh, nice.
Within seconds of being inside, like me and the realtor were just looking at each other like, what? But back to geospatial data. So all of that is possible because of the metadata that is entered in from these listings. So you've got, mm-hmm. you know, an address, you've got different attributes in a table that are all tied into the listing of this house, and you've got pictures and stuff. And on a good platform, it's easy to search, it's easy to visualize, and you can view the data and search the data in a meaningful way that produces results and so on and so forth. The same goes for like archaeology. And I can't tell you, like, I've looked at some really bad listings for houses, but I've also, for archaeology, I've looked at some really bad geospatial data collections for archaeology. And all of it has to do with metadata. Get as much metadata as you can, but collect it in a meaningful manner. And mm-hmm. all of that, it just goes to say that it all ties into your research design. And you've got to think about the end product and the end, I don't know, I'm all wrapped up in tech speak now, the end user experience.
Yeah.
And so, you know, basically the end user experience from an archaeology perspective is, you know, your client or even you when you're visualizing this data, you know, you want SHPO to eventually approve your report, or you want, you know, any reader of your report to be able to understand it. And if you have, you know, a web-based, you know, mapping platform, and there's tons of them out there, you want somebody to be able to look at that and know what on earth they're looking at and actually have something meaningful there. And if you have site overview photos, a table of artifacts, you've got maybe pictures of, you know, representative artifact collections and stuff, you can have some really meaningful visualization and really meaningful data representation there, and you can search mm-hmm. it, and you can correlate it, and you can look back at the associations of that in context with other sites, so you can then start to approach things like regional research questions and other hypotheses. And so there's my little rant. I'm not really talking about an app per se, but just, you know, mind your metadata.
Nice. I think, you know, when you first told me you were going to do this, I wasn't sure what I was going to be able to comment on this, but as you were saying that, it made me think, like a lot of things that we do in archaeology, there are parallels in other things that we do, and we don't really see the parallels sometimes. Like, for example, when I got my first iPad a week after they were debuted on the market, people were like, what are you going to do with this thing? What the hell is going to happen? And I was instantly, like a month later, I was recording, you know, I was recording information on basically a cemetery at the University of Georgia, and I was using it in the field, not very effectively. I'd never done it before, but, you know, I was using it, and then I started just kind of looking from that point on. But the point is, we've probably all used some sort of app that has geospatial data, and you're like, no, I don't think I ever have. I've never used Zillow. Well, have you used Yelp? Have you used the Maps app on your phone and then tapped on a thing that you found? And then data came up. That's all just metadata. That's all attributes applied to a point on a map. And there's no reason why we shouldn't have that level of detail for archaeology. We're collecting that level of detail in a number of cases out in the field, but then we're not applying it very well. We're putting it in a GIS maybe that stays on our computer, at our servers, at our company. And then when we send all the stuff to the SHPO, maybe some of that information gets put in. Usually it's a funding problem with the SHPO. They can't, you know, they can't create these nice things for us. But it's, you know, we're collecting the information. We should have the information. I'd like to think that with the kind of the 10-year rule in Nevada here and probably other states where if a site was recorded more than 10 years ago, it's re-recorded. Well, we're getting to the point in 2017 where sites recorded in 2007 and 2008, probably with a submeter GPS, probably with a digital camera, probably with some other things, are now being re-recorded. And if I'm re-recording that site that was likely put into a GIS or something like that, I really should have the data when I go out into the field. I should see just like, you know, maps on houses on Zillow, or, you know, craft kombucha distilleries in Portland on Yelp. I should be able to click on one of these artifacts or one of these features and see a laundry list of things. I should see the description of the artifact. I should see the measurements. I should see everything that they did, the photographs. I should be able to see all that right on my tablet or whatever I have in the field.
Right. And when you have to fill out the site forms, you're filling out things like distance to water and yeah. other features and stuff like that. And all of those go into, you know, research questions that are based on, you know, human behavior and whatnot.
Right.
But all of that is also a spatial relationship to other things that can be plotted. Mm-hmm. And those are things that can be handled on these,
right.
You know, whether it's a GIS platform or even just an app. Like, there are some surprisingly powerful apps out there. And mm-hmm. it's funny that there's such an intersection with, you know, here we are on the Archaeotech podcast, and it's the intersection of technology and innovation and archaeology. But mm-hmm. when it comes to things like this, you're looking at, you know, if you know GIS and you can do it in an archaeological context, great. But if you know Python and you can do that to ArcGIS, and you can do that to archaeology, then you're moving leaps and bounds beyond anything that anybody else is doing. That's when you can get into like predictive modeling. That's when you can go into, you know, actually pushing the boundaries of theory and method and stuff like that. So I think it's a really fascinating area of archaeology, the intersection of coding and programming and spatial technology.
Yeah, absolutely. So, well, let's close out this segment and close out this podcast. I'd like to see in the comments, wherever you see this episode, your favorite apps for displaying and or adding to metadata. I'm especially interested in ones where you can add to metadata, not like archaeology even, but, you know, something else. Like, for example, with Yelp as an example, I can leave a comment. I can leave a thing. I can actually add to the metadata for that site. You know, usually, of course, like Yelp, it's a one-star review because, you know, the waitress spilled something all over my head. But but apps like that, think outside the box. And then think about how we can apply that sort of method or that user experience to something in archaeology. And then let us know about it. We might actually be able to do something about that. So, again, leave that in the comments for the show. Archaeotech/52 on arcpodnet.com. Or on Facebook, you can leave an angry rant about the 130,000-year-old mastodon. I promise not to sick Tom King on you because he's pretty vicious on some other threats we've seen. You know, we'll just let you do your little rant and then move on because we're scientists. But yeah, anyway, thanks for listening to the show. Chris, anything else?
No, thanks for listening to the show, and we'll see you in a couple weeks.
Awesome. That's it for another episode of the Archaeotech Podcast. Links to some of the items mentioned on the show are in the show notes for this podcast, which can be found at www.archaeologypodcastnetwork.com/archaeotech. If you like the show and want to comment, please do. You can leave comments about this or any other episode on the website or on the iTunes page for this episode. You can also email us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com or use the contact form on the podcast webpage. If you'd like us to answer a question on a future episode, email us. Use the contact form on the website or tweet your questions with the #archaeotech or tag @arcpodnet in your tweet. Please share the link to this show wherever you saw it. If you'd like to subscribe to this podcast, you can do so on iTunes or on Stitcher Radio. You can also type the name of the podcast into your favorite podcasting app and subscribe that way. Don't forget to go over to iTunes and leave a review of the show. It helps us get noticed so more people can find our podcast and benefit from the content. Also, send us show suggestions and interview suggestions. We want this to be a resource for field technicians everywhere, and we want to know what you want to know about. This show is produced by Chris Webster and Tristan Boyle, and was edited by Chris Webster.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archaeologypodcastnetwork.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.
Thanks again for listening to this episode and for supporting the Archaeology Podcast Network. If you want these shows to keep going, consider becoming a member for just $7.99 a month. That's cheaper than a venti quad eggnog latte. Go to arcpodnet.com/members for more info.